What's up, founders, and welcome to the In Demand podcast, where we talk all about how to troubleshoot growth for your PLG SaaS. I'm your co-host, Asia Arangio, the CEO and founder of Demand Maven.
And I'm Kim Talarczyk, client services manager at Demand Maven, where we help SaaS companies reach their toughest growth milestones.
All right, Kim, let's get into it.
Hey, Asia.
Hey.
So we got an RFP today that came in through email, you saw.
We did, which is rare. Usually RFP processes, I consider them to be for bigger companies.
Yeah. This is what they said, 3 million in revenue?
Yeah. 3 million ARR, which I felt like was like, oh, that's kind of small for an RFP. But maybe that's just my perspective.
Yeah, maybe. Because yeah, we just don't see that.
Yeah.
But what they said in the RFP was that their problem was churn. And they need to solve that problem. They're trying to get to 5 to 10 million. They think that's the reason. So that's kind of inspired what we want to talk about today.
Yeah, which we've had it on the list to talk about the churn playbook anyway. But this actually just kind of made it like, we should spend some time on this because churn is one of those things that you hear the word a lot. As an earlier stage bootstrapped founder or even VC funded founder, you do and should care a lot about churn. And I think in those early days, there's a lot of focus on it. I think the moment that you start, you grow to a point where you have like manageable or expected churn. So like you're in that 3-5% average monthly churn. That's when a lot of people don't focus on it anymore. Like they kind of either turn a blind eye or they kind of like accept that, oh, yep, 3-5, that's finger quotes healthy. And now we're going to move on into other things. Mm-hmm. And what I think is so interesting about this is that while it is true that for most B2B SaaS companies, and I would also say within B2C to an extent, 3-5% monthly average churn net is probably healthy or at least acceptable, but it is by no means the minimum. It's not the ceiling at all. I've seen net negative churn, for example. So like you're growing and expanding accounts faster than you're losing them, which results in negative churn, which to me is the dream. But I've also seen at least certain contexts where 5% is actually too much. You really need to be closer to 2-3%. And sometimes I'm the bearer of bad news in scenarios like that. So for example, B2C, for example, we would ideally see much less churn than that. 2-3% would be ideal. There are certain B2B contexts where more than 3%, but no more than 5% would be considered acceptable. And I think that surprises a lot of founders is when they're like, oh yeah, you know, I've got 5%, 6%. And it's like, actually, that's still double what it should be. So like you probably need to be closer to 3% to have a more sustainable business model. But churn is ultimately relative to the growth rate anyway. So you might be able to afford more or higher churn based on how you're adding to the top of the funnel, how you're converting them, like the efficiencies there. So the monthly churn rate is something that as a number, you do kind of take it at face value. But at the same time, we do have to scrutinize it a little bit because churn is so much more complex than this. And I think like, again, a lot of people, they over-index on that monthly churn number and they under-index on all the things that play into that number. So for example, monthly churn, so if we were to define churn, the simplest way to define it is what percentage of people month over month cancel their subscriptions? And that percentage, if we were to break it down further, then it would be, well, what percentage of that churn was qualified versus unqualified? And this is an important distinction because a lot of people don't measure qualified versus unqualified churn. When I was on the board of Moz, we measured unqualified versus qualified churn. And the reason why was because not all of the signups that we got for the product were considered qualified, which means if and when they become customers, we did not believe in adding that to our ultimate like overall churn number. We wanted to make sure to separate that out. So when we looked at qualified churn versus unqualified churn is really the number that matters the most. Unqualified churn, we know that they're not qualified. They're not necessarily the best fit for us. We know that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that we want that number like blended in with our main one. We want to be able to see both. And also because at the end of the day, like we're not going to tell people go away. Some people just have specific use cases that the product fulfills for some specific time or what have you. But this is why we recommend splitting that number up into qualified versus unqualified. Now, you might—
And you're saying don't really worry about the unqualified churn.
I think it's something that you should keep track of. But I do think that the where you would worry about it is if you find that you have a huge amount of unqualified churn and it's like over, it's the primary number basically that's taking up like that full average. Mm-hmm. So for example, if a very small percentage of your churn is actually qualified, that to me says like, oh, we're probably struggling with acquisition actually.
Yeah.
Or we might need to look at that unqualified churn and ask ourselves, are they actually unqualified? Why? Is this a market opportunity? So like, it's not a worry as much as like a keep tabs on and track.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And the way that you understand your qualified versus unqualified churn, it all starts with that sign up form or the book a demo form or whatever it is, like whatever data you collect upon the person whenever they sign up, chances are like you're collecting more than just a name and an email address, which is what I would recommend. I actually wouldn't recommend just only collecting those things depending on the product that you have, because you probably do need a little bit more data to like pre-qualify someone, but you would base it off of that information that you collect. This really shouldn't be anything exhaustive. It should be like 2 to 3 questions max, but assuming that you're collecting name and email address and maybe like one other thing, those 2 to 3, you know, questions that you use to pre-qualify, it's not going to like break your form. I promise. You're not going to see like a crazy drop off on that conversion rate. It's probably going to change it like a percentage, if that. It's probably going to be more like a half of a percentage of a change. But that data is what you would use actually to determine was this qualified or unqualified. And hopefully they don't churn. But if and when they do, because you will get churn, you'll actually be able to segment those two, qualified versus unqualified. So churn already, we're looking at two. It's actually not just one number. It's actually two numbers. And then the other number, which I've talked about before on the podcast and also speaking, is net revenue retention. So monthly churn only tells the story for that month. But what about cohorted churn over time? Meaning all of the customers that you got last June, how many of those same customers do you still have in June now? So that's what we call cohorted retention. Or cohorted churn. But a cohort looks at from this group of people, that same group of people, how many do you still have later? Or how many of those of that same exact group over time did something or whatever? So that's the cohort. Net revenue retention basically says, out of all the customers that I've gotten in a given month, how many of those do I still have 6 months later, 12 months later, 24 months later? And then you do that for, let's say, January of last year. You repeat that same for February. So you say, okay, everyone that I got in February, how many of those do I still have 6 months later, 12 months later? You do that for every single month, and you can go backwards in time however long you want. And depending on the time frame that you look at, so if you look at the last 12 months of net revenue retention, so it's June now. So you'd go from June 2024 to June 2025. That's 12 months. Some people can even go 24 months back in time. But you end up with this chart that it'll list every single month vertically, and then horizontally, it should list that retention percentage month over month following. And at the very bottom of this chart, you'll see on average what your 1 month net revenue retention was, 2 month, yada, 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 up to 12 month and 24 month. Now, the number that is the most critical for SaaS companies, if you're a SaaS company, this number tells me how healthy your business is and if it's on the struggle bus or not, is if you're a SaaS company, meaning you're subscription-based, recurring revenue model, at 12 months, you need to be at least 100% if you want to be growing. 80%, 80 to 100 is comfortable growth. This is, I mean, it's not like lightning fast, but it's comfortable. Anything less than 80%, or even I would say 75%, is going to be slow. It's going to feel like you have to really, like you're pushing a boulder up a mountain. If you're at 100% net revenue retention or more, it's really more like you're guiding a boulder down a mountain and you're trying to make sure it doesn't fall off the mountain. Like, growth is relatively effortless, except for the energy that you're putting in to make sure the boulder doesn't fall off. But when you're less than 80%, 12-month net revenue retention, you are pushing a boulder up a mountain and it feels hard and everything. And it is the type of like growth that it makes you feel like everything you do doesn't work or you're not really sure what's working. Everything from like, well, we did all this like acquisition stuff and I don't really know. And like, we're doing stuff over here in activation. We're doing stuff over here, but like, it feels very scattered and everything you do doesn't really seem to have a positive effect. But actually what is happening in the background is you're likely churning more than you're keeping and you have to put more energy and effort into acquiring more and hopefully keeping more. But again, it's a sneaky, leaky bucket. So when you've got more than 5% monthly churn, that's really obvious. But when you don't, when you're in that healthy range, and I'm putting that in finger quotes because you can be 3% monthly churn and still have poor net revenue retention. It's possible. We've seen it. And there's a number of reasons why. But a lot of the times, that's the sneaky churn. And sneaky long-term churn, that's the enemy of your business. But again, if it's less than 80%, and I would say even 75%, growth is going to feel challenging, difficult. And if it's less than 60%, what that tells me is you literally got to replace half your revenue every year. And that is ridiculously challenging, or it can be. And it's also very expensive. You're literally paying double to keep a pool of customers. And it is usually not a growing pool of customers. Usually, like, again, it's really more like flat growth. You've probably been stagnant for a long time. But all that to say, so those are the numbers. And I've talked about net revenue retention before. There is actually, I learned about this recently. Some VCs actually use GRR, which is gross revenue retention, which basically says out of all of the money ever that we've made, how much money have we kept? Which is very interesting because you can also look at this as like gross customer retention as well. Out of all the customers that we've ever had, how many of them do we still have? And I want to say that the numbers are a little bit more lenient here, but not by much. So it's something like it would be acceptable, for example, to have 80% GRR or GRC, excuse me, GCR, gross customer retention. But it really does depend on the situation because I think a lot of companies do kind of go through a pivot, for example, or like when you first go to market versus like the version of go to market that you're on now, like you might not be acquiring the same type of customer. So this is kind of where I would say like GRR and GCR are interesting, but I find that they may not be as applicable to Bootstrap because Bootstrap founders do tend to pivot their businesses over long periods of time. And it just may not make sense to like use that unless you're using it for a specific period of time. But it is still interesting. Mm-hmm. Net revenue retention is my favorite. It gets even better though when you can segment. So ProfitWell can give you the high level net revenue retention. Like if you use ProfitWell, you already have this report in your account right now. You could literally log in, go navigate to it and go find it and go look at it because most of you, I would almost guarantee, have never seen it. I know that for a fact because I've given talks about this and every time I get dozens of people being like, I had no idea I had that report. I didn't know what it was. I've seen it before, but I didn't know what it meant. So
that's very interesting. So, but people are looking at their monthly churn percentage, but they're not looking at that report.
They're not looking at NRR. And I think it's because they don't understand it and they don't know what to do about it if it's bad, which we're actually going to talk about today. But yeah, so this report already exists. But ProfitWell in particular does not do segmented NRR, meaning so that report is going to give you the aggregate. These are all the subscriptions, all the customers. But you want to go even deeper into this. And this is where you would look at specific segments. So for example, customer types, or you could also look at plan types. So which plans have better net revenue retention than others? And you'd look at the segment. So you'd look at just people on the pro plan or just people on your grow plan or just people on whatever. if you are collecting data about the type of user or if you're pre-qualifying folks as they sign up for the product, you could also do net revenue retention based on that data too. So for example, maybe you're targeting teachers and maybe you're targeting like coaches and maybe you're targeting professional trainers. You could look at the net revenue retention for each of those segments. And that's important because you may decide strategically, oh, teachers is the way to go. We should spend like we should invest more in growing that as a segment. And you may also decide, oh man, coaches are really struggling. We can either decide to invest there or not. And that's why net revenue retention is so powerful, because when you like, yes, like looking at it at a whole is important, but then when you dig deeper, suddenly that monthly churn number, seeing it in aggregate is kind of helpful. Like it gives you like a general litmus test, but it doesn't really give you the details of, okay, well, what part of the customer base is suffering or doing amazing? And like, we should really put some energy there, either one. So those are two metrics that we use. And going a little bit deeper, we can get deeper into this. Again, not all platforms do this, but it is technically possible to calculate manually. And also there are platforms that do this out of the box. I believe ChartMogul does, if I'm not mistaken. But all that to say, those are two critical numbers. So qualified versus unqualified churn and the net revenue retention.
Yeah. So churn is nuanced. It's not, you might think you have good churn, but maybe you don't, or maybe it's just not straightforward. You know, it sounds like a lot of people are not really getting the full story when they're looking at some churn numbers.
Right. And I think the other thing too is, and moving more into the qualitative side of things, a lot of people do track cancellation reasons. So, you know, when someone cancels their account, a lot of people do require a cancellation reason. And if you aren't currently requiring a cancellation reason, you should start requiring one. It should not be optional, in my opinion. Now, I don't believe in the whole like call to cancel or email us to cancel. I think that's bull. I think you should just be able to, like, if you can self-serve the product, you should be able to self-serve cancel, but you should ask a couple of questions first. So if you're not already doing that, you should absolutely do it. But what's interesting though, is it's important to remember that even if you collect cancellation reason, that's actually not the real reason. And I say that because we have done churn research before. We've done churn analysis before. And what we find is that it's actually very rarely ever one reason. It's usually several reasons. And it's usually several reasons that have compiled up into enough of a moving force that they now feel pulled away from the product and pushed in a different direction. If you're familiar with Jobs to be Done Four Forces, you know about pushes and pulls. So things that push you versus like towards a product, things that, you know, pull you away and also technically, I guess, pull you towards the product. But all that to say, there are things that are pushing you again towards the product and things that are kind of holding you back, so to speak. It's probably a better way to describe it. Mm-hmm. And when churn happens, what's basically happening is it's never just one thing. It's a culmination of things and it becomes a force that's more powerful than staying. And those reasons, it's, I dare say, cute to collect the cancellation reason. You should collect those. But you have to take it with somewhat of a grain of salt, because when you conduct interviews about this, which we'll talk a little bit about, but not too much because it's not too wildly different from our typical process. However, what we may find is that actually there are a lot of different reasons. And some of those are controllable and some of those are not controllable. Like there are things that happen that just get in the way of a customer continuing to be a customer. People change jobs, lose jobs. Sometimes it's like the context that enabled them to become a customer just quite literally goes away. Maybe you were selling something to moms. Well, maybe those kids grow up and like the mom doesn't need that thing anymore. Like there's all kinds of reasons why someone leaves. And for the things that are not controllable, it's good to understand them. And it's also good to understand them too, because it helps you identify qualification. So are there patterns that create good customers versus customers who are probably going to leave in an unprecedented amount of time? Because again, it costs money to acquire customers. So if they don't stay for a long enough time, then it's not going to be profitable. But when it comes to controllable scenarios, and I want everyone to think beyond just features, but like controllable scenarios like confusion or, oh, I didn't know that your product could do that. Things like that. All it takes is for a company that seems to be better, that maybe has a better way of explaining things, that maybe has a better experience or what have you, for someone to leave. And those are controllable scenarios.
And they can't be nailed down in a form.
Right.
You're not clicking one of those things, or someone is not writing you an essay of all the things that you just said.
Rarely will you get the essay. I mean, those are special people. Like, people who give you essays are they're unique. They're not the norm. Most people open up – this happens to me all the time. Anytime I cancel software, I'll literally open up the form and I'll be like, man, none of these are actually the reason why I'm canceling. So then I just pick one, literally.
Right.
I make it up.
Or one of them's kind of close but not really, and
yeah,
just click somewhere.
And like, sure, there's a little box to put in other – but I'm not going to type too much because I'm trying to cancel.
Right.
And so much of me is like, man, I wish I could have given them more feedback throughout this process. But that's me. I'm probably also rare. But I can imagine that most people are like, yeah, no, it's actually none of these, or it's complicated and I really don't want to explain it. So I'm just going to pick something.
So this is why you do churn interviews. And now, do you actually get people that want to talk to you? Because these are the people that just want to click that button and cancel, right?
Yeah. So I think that there are a couple of interesting, or at least like savvy, ways to do this. I think there are, of course, you can incentivize an interview. Ideally, when you pick churn interviews, you're looking for people who you really want to talk to, as many people as you possibly can in general, just but like over longer time horizons, right? Because realistically speaking, you're not going to have that much time to do too many interviews all the time. But when you do churn sprints, which you should absolutely do of some kind, I like to start with people who were relatively active. So you really have four buckets of people. And I want you to imagine a matrix. There's qualified versus unqualified. And then there's activated versus inactivated. So people who achieved the right activation metrics versus maybe people who did not. And so if you can imagine, those two columns create this matrix of qualified activated people, qualified unactivated people, unqualified activated people, then unqualified inactive people. The unqualified inactive, I don't know that we spend too much energy there, but the qualified activated and the qualified unactivated or inactive, those are really the people that we really want to spend energy on. And then unqualified but activated, that's really more to me like opportunity space. They're unqualified on paper, but maybe getting them on the phone and actually understanding, like, are they actually unqualified? Because we've seen this before where sometimes on paper we're like, oh, they meet some requirements that to us means that they're not qualified. But then when we get them on the phone, we're like, oh, actually, you actually are qualified. How did we miss you? Like, how did you fall through the cracks? And then we start rethinking a little bit about not just like sign up flow, but also onboarding activation experience. Like what happened in our experience that either led you to not have a good experience, or what was missing, or what information did you need? And all of that culminates into patterns. So what's cool about churn research is it's very similar to UX research. You don't need that many of them in that like, a handful of like 5 to 10 is actually is plenty, like especially if you're picking people from each of those boxes.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that 5 to 10 a sprinkling of all those categories that you just mentioned?
Yeah. So talking to 5 people in the qualified inactive bucket, talking to 5 people in the qualified activated bucket. Yeah.
Okay.
So in total, and again, this is why we call it a sprint, because you can either decide to sprinkle these out over time, or you can crunch it all up into like 2 weeks. Up to you. Like whatever makes the most sense for you. But what I find is a lot of teams work best in sprints. Yeah, you might actually end up conducting 15 to 20 total, but you don't need that many from each of those like buckets, so to speak. And a lot of the times, it's also because you hear the same things over and over again, not even just like in what the customer says as much as like, or former customer, but more like in their patterns. Like you'll notice that there are patterns with what creates a churn pattern and what creates a retention pattern. Now, I will say it's really important though, that if you've never done any type of research ever before, like you've never even talked to like good paying customers, churn research actually is going to feel kind of confusing because you don't really know what positive things to look for. So it's kind of like a science experiment. Like there's a control and there's a variable. Your control is going to be good paying customers that stay. So you do want to have that context already before you do this type of work.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, you're going to be missing that, like the control. The variable is actually churning.
Right. You want to know who your great customers are.
Right.
That you want to replicate.
Exactly. Because if you don't, you're going to hear stuff in your churn research and you're not going to know, like, is that good or not? Does that create retention or does that create churn? Like, you're just not going to be able to sort the patterns as well. You'll probably be able to intuitively sort through, but you may end up thinking that, like, you might end up with false positives. And we want to reduce that as much as possible. You're going to have some false positives anyway. It's impossible to reduce all the bias, obviously. But it's pretty critical that we've got the control and the variable. If we only have the variable, then it's tough to know, like, well, what's weird about this or not? So I will say that. And then from there, it's when you have these churn interviews, you really want the full story for what led to the churn. And sometimes it's not just a feature was missing. Again, sometimes it's things like, oh, well, I wanted to accomplish X, but I didn't know how to do that. Or sometimes you'll hear that people request things. This happens all the time. You'll hear that people request things and it's like, well, the product can do that. The product can literally do that. Which in these interviews, it's not our responsibility to retain these customers. Usually we're here to troubleshoot like what's going on. So we're not going to pitch the customer like in the call or anything of like, oh, well, I can do that. Like that's
right. Let me show you how.
Yeah. Like that's something to be done after the call. But it's always fascinating because a lot of the times what we're hearing is actually just the business doesn't have a good product marketing function and they're not doing enough of a job of educating people about the features or creating enough of a community that makes it interesting and engaging to want to learn about what's new. Because sometimes I think, you know, a lot of companies blast their product updates into the ether, but there's no real like customer community around the product. And so that can fall flat. Excuse me. But apart from that, we've also heard things like, of course, you know, things that are controllable, at least. We've heard tons of uncontrollable things. But in the controllable world, we've also heard things like they suddenly have a new job to be done because the product satisfied the first couple of jobs to be done. And now there are new jobs to be done and the product doesn't do that. And so they start hunting for something else. And this to me is a product management issue. What it says to me is, are we doing a good enough job of identifying product opportunities that create growth, both growth in expansion and in retention? Because in, you know, you can't build everything, but for those qualified people who were activated, we care maybe more because they clearly came to the product with intention, used it to some extent, and then for some reason or several reasons left. We really want to make sure we understand the opportunity space so that we don't accidentally lose customers over the long haul because we're not addressing enough jobs to be done over time. Jobs to be done is not a perfect framework or approach to understanding customers. And I would even say, like, from a product management perspective, it's also not a perfect tool for understanding all the opportunity spaces. But what I will say is I think it's an easy way to look at it. So for example, if you know that your product helps, like let's say you're running a bank, you are helping people store money, you're helping people spend money, but you might not be helping people gain investments and, or like secure an investment, I should say. And people like who are high quality customers may suddenly have that need. So for example, Silicon Valley Bank, I think if I'm not mistaken, they have an arm that's like investment. And that's a jobs to be done that not every bank focuses on because of their clientele, of like who they're focused on from a customer market, go-to-market perspective. But if you can imagine Silicon Valley Bank, you know, they're supposed to be targeting founders and entrepreneurs. It'd be kind of wild if they didn't offer some type of investment arm of some kind, whereas people can secure funding in some kind of way, whether from the bank or from maybe they have some product or something that enables them to do that, financially speaking. But that's the type of thing that we have to make sure we're keeping an ear and an eye out for, because that type of stuff creates long-term churn. You have a customer mm-hmm. for 8 months, that 10-month rolls around and it's like, man, I need something more than this. And if it's painful enough, they'll look for something else. But if it's not, they'll stay, but they may not be like the biggest raving fan. It just depends. Of course, we also talk a lot about in the product management process about quality of life improvements versus value generators. And usually what we see is with churn research, what we learn is how much of it was this product wasn't generating enough value for me for what I was paying versus I was struggling with the everyday experience and I needed a lot of quality of life improvements. It was too hard to use, or there were things I needed to be able to do that I wasn't able to do, but they're like minor tweaks, little stuff, stuff that's like not really like a feature, but like a modification to an existing feature. And those are the types of things that we're listening for, at least on the experiential side. And what we find is like, it really depends per product, because we've heard a lot of things. But what we find is usually there's a story behind poor churn or scary long-term churn. And it's some combination of those two things.
And how are you making sure that you're not getting a bunch of people that say, well, I just don't have the money for this anymore?
Yeah. Which is tough. So usually there's some type of like when it comes to like pre-qualifying people to like to talk to, if we're selecting our customer panel or former customer panel, so to speak, we're looking for certain qualities of that account. They had very high or very interesting product engagement. Maybe they had several users. Like there are indicators of what makes an account high value or high, like highly engaged. Now on the inactivated side, yeah, there's a little tougher because you might get people who are like, oh yeah, I was just out of my budget or whatever. Sometimes those folks, assuming that you have the cancellation reason, sometimes they do self-identify. We are also comparing cancellation reason against some of those product behaviors and product activities. Usually we'll have a discussion or several discussions about like, okay, here's what we're seeing. Here's our analysis. Here's what we think we should look for. Now let's build a list based off of these criterion. But it's always like it's definitely more intuitive than I think it is like science. Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit of science and art, but it does feel a little bit more on the art side sometimes.
And there's always a few interviews that it's just like, okay, we're going to kind of toss those to the side and let's book a few more. And so you're getting the patterns that you need.
But apart from that, so we do recommend incentivizing interviews to an extent. I would actually be open to testing this again, like in our next iteration of this, because when you offer a gift card to customers, it's like you actually want the variation that comes with that. I think more than operating off of like the bias of goodwill. But when it comes to churned folks, offering the gift card kind of sometimes is just like you might get someone who really isn't qualified and also was totally not active. But assuming that we have some data points, we can mitigate that to an extent. But yeah, like sometimes you do get the person who's like, I just want the gift card. But you should be getting some insight from them in some kind of way. But I do think it kind of depends. But there's always like one or two of those folks anyway.
Yeah, that's probably inevitable. And I do feel like that gift card does help bring people in.
It definitely.
And when you get them on the phone, I'm actually surprised that I see, wow, these people are really talking to us. And I also think it's the way we approach the interviews.
Yeah.
And how we're running it like a jobs to be done type, and we're getting their context, and it's less, what do you mean you didn't like it? And did you try this?
Right.
It's not like that.
Yeah. And the gift card attracts many different types of people, whereas not offering one really only attracts one type of person. And that's the person who just wants to help. And they have a lot of thoughts and opinions, but I think I would take a varied audience over like the goodwill audience, like pretty much any day, even though we like the goodwill audience. But it is very clearly biased. And I see that now after many years of doing this, but yeah, the gift card does hit a little different, but ideally we're pre-qualifying as much as possible on our end before we make that offer to people, because it is possible to get a lot of folks who are just like, it's they're both unqualified and also weren't very active.
Right. But yeah, overall, because we've run into clients that are like, what do you mean you want to talk to our churn customers? They don't want to talk to us, or we can't bother them.
You can totally bother them.
And it's actually the opposite. And it's, we've seen like, oh, wow, this was super valuable and helpful. So
yeah,
definitely don't be afraid of talking to churn customers.
In terms of order of operations of like, who's easiest to talk to? Paying customers. Then it's actually churned customers. And then it's active trialists and then inactive trialists. Inactive trialists are the hardest group to talk to, hands down. People who sign up and then ghost, those people are impossible. Like and we try. I think there's been a handful of times where we've actually been able to get those folks on the phone, but most of the time they're actually harder than churned people, in my opinion.
And is that, I wonder if that's because is there just very little brand recognition? They have spent so little time with the brand.
Yeah, there's low fealty for sure. There's no loyalty there. I think it's also like my assumption too is like if they're inactive, specifically in that trial phase, they've either decided already like this is not for me and like it's not worth it for me to tell these people, which we beg to differ. Our perspective is obviously different because I would like to know that and I'd like to know why. But their perspective is like, there's no way that it makes sense for me to talk to these people. The flip side to that is that they're already not paying attention. So like, if they're an inactive trialist, they signed up, they probably already forgot about it. There's no way they're paying attention to those emails because they were inactive, right? Like they weren't, like if email was really going to save them, then they probably would talk to us, but clearly not. So, so all that to say, like, I think that that's actually the hardest group ever because yeah, there is no, even churned customers, even if they're frustrated, usually they're happy to get paid to vent their frustrations. You know what I mean? Like, which we're like, yeah, tell us. We want to hear about it.
Yep.
And what works about that too is like, we're a neutral third party, so they can go ham and it doesn't bother us because we're genuinely curious. But we're also trying to understand like, again, what creates a pattern for churn versus not.
Yeah.
And then within churn analysis, this process ultimately nets a couple of things. So the first thing is it's going to really force you to understand what are the patterns that create a churn versus not, what is truly within our control versus not. And then finally, it should reveal opportunities across several areas of the business. So usually it reveals opportunities across acquisition. It usually tells you like, man, are we doing a bad job of making it clear to maybe not good fit customers, like, hey, we don't do this feature, or like, hey, we do charge this. You know what I mean? Like, let's make it very clear so that way people who maybe aren't the best fit can self-select or opt out entirely and be like, oh, okay, not for me, got it. Because sometimes it's an issue of we're actually attracting too many of the wrong type of customer because we're not making it clear enough upfront that like, if you need this, or if you only want to pay that, or if you're trying to accomplish this, this is not for you. So sometimes that happens and that's, you know, it's an acquisition issue.
Yep.
In addition to like go to market. Sometimes you might discover that there are pricing issues and monetization issues. Sometimes you'll discover that there are product marketing issues. So people who are needing help with something, but either can't find it easily in help documents or don't understand that you can actually accomplish the thing. Because we've heard that in interviews too. I think the last time we did a churn project like this, we heard from several customers that like, oh, I wish I could do this. And the founder later was like, it can do that. It can do that. And it's like, okay, well, you have a product marketing issue. Like, and I know it sounds so simple to say, but like, we've got to figure out how do you make, and an activation issue actually as well. Because that's the type of stuff that they should be learning in the activation process. Right. Speaking of, you might learn that there are activation issues. People, again, who never got fully activated because of various hurdles, again, could be controllable, could be non-controllable, but the controllable ones, you want to make sure you're documenting and understanding because you might notice patterns across people that you talk to. So for example, if you discover that it's, let's say you're a translation management software, it's really hard to translate something. Like that's the type of thing that can reveal an issue. There are other scenarios too, like we worked on a company that did, they were a qualitative research platform. So they actually helped people completing like their dissertations or docs qualitatively analyze transcripts. That was what the product did. And we discovered that actually people were really struggling with certain aspects of the product. And that was why they were leaving. And also we discovered that there were actually a lot of growth opportunities. Like the reason why they were leaving was, again, because there were jobs that they knew jobs that they had that the product didn't satisfy. And so they would use it for a little bit and then move on.
Right.
But yeah, those tend to be the outcomes of this type of analysis and the type of conclusions that you can arrive at. All of these things tier up to that net revenue retention. So that's why it's so important to document, to understand, and to do, and to not just take your monthly churn number at face value, because there could be a lot more happening under the covers, I guess.
Or the surface.
Yeah, that's a much better example. Okay, cool. That's everything that off the top of my head about churn. What did we miss? Did we miss anything?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, I hope that this inspires everyone to look at their churn a little bit more deeply, because my guess is that there's a lot more happening.
Right. It's probably not straightforward. And we also have a podcast on onboarding and activation as well, which we touched on a little bit today. So we have a playbook for that.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, cool. All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks all.